President Joe Biden concedes a bad debate performance and tries to reassure panicked supporters he's up for the task.
I give you my word as a Biden, I would not be running again if I didn't believe with all my heart and soul I can do this job.
Plus, Donald Trump seizes on Biden's debate performance.
This election is a choice between strength and weakness, competence and incompetence.
And a ruling on the fate of the former president's claims of immunity from criminal prosecution is expected Monday on the Supreme Court's last day of the session. Today is Saturday, June 29th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
I know how to do this job. I know how to get things done. And I know, like millions of Americans know, when you get knocked down, you get back up.
President Joe Biden held a campaign rally in Raleigh, North Carolina Friday, vigorously working to calm Democratic anxiety a day after his shaky debate performance, but vowing to win and accusing Donald Trump of breaking a record for the most lies told in a single debate.
I don't walk as easy as I used to. I don't speak as smoothly as I used to. I don't debate as well as I used to. But I know what I do know. I know how to tell the truth. I know right from wrong.
Donald Trump, campaigning in Virginia, looked to capitalize on Biden's poor showing in the debate.
He got the date that he wanted. He got the network that he wanted with the moderates he wanted. No amount of rest or rigging could help him defend his atrocious record. It's not defensible.
The debate was contentious from the start. Trump projected confidence and certitude even when he was wrong on the facts. Biden at times was faltering and had some difficulty finishing his thoughts. Joining us now for some perspective is Jessica Taylor, political analyst and editor with the Cook Political Report. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's just start with your overall assessment of the debate.
I think from the moment Biden walked on stage, even before he started speaking, it was reinforcing what voters' biggest concerns are about him, is that he is too old and not up to the job. And he did nothing throughout that debate to allay those concerns. And in fact, I think he played into them and just reinforced the belief. What was clearly on display last night was that he may not be up for the job. But we saw Trump really not back away from a lot of his persona, continuing to tell falsehoods and lies, you know, avoiding repeated questions about whether he would accept the results of the election and continuing to peddle falsehoods that the 2020 election was stolen. And so, you know, the voters that will decide this election, if you were voting for Biden, you're already probably voting for Biden. If you are already voting for Trump, you're already voting for Trump. You know, that slice of the electorate that is still undecided, and that even if they voted for Biden, perhaps in 2020, I don't think that debate did anything to move those voters to Biden's side. And that should really worry Democrats in the White House.
Do you think that it moved them to think about voting for Trump, or do you think it's more likely that some of these people that weren't sure will just not vote?
I've always thought that Biden's biggest problem is not necessarily Trump, but it's apathy among the base and among, we see Democrats doing, Biden specifically underperforming with, you know, key Democratic constituencies, including younger voters, Black voters and Hispanic voters. And I don't think it convinced them to vote for Trump, but it could have convinced them to not vote at all, or to stay home, or to vote for third party. So I think that is the biggest fear. I think that should be Democrats' biggest fear right now.
Right. Because if they stay home or vote for a third party, it helps Trump, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
What about the calls that we're hearing 5 months away from the election? There are calls to have him drop out of the race. Is that sort of an unprecedented situation, and how likely would that be?
I mean, the signals we are still getting out of the Biden team is that he will not do that. You know, things that I have heard are that probably the only person who could convince Biden to do that is the First Lady, his wife, Jill Biden. And you know, she was very complimentary afterwards of his debate performance. We will see whether sort of the elders of the party can step in. You know, does fundraising drop off? off, because one of Biden's biggest advantages was he had this massive fundraising edge. But with the influx that Trump got after his conviction earlier this month, that's been narrowed. And if you look at the elders of the party, it is Biden, you know, but I mean, does Obama step in? Does Bill Clinton, who is someone that could get to Biden? Like I said, I think it comes down to his family. And if they're still encouraging him to stay in, I don't see him stepping aside, but it certainly could make for an interesting, you know, Biden is not officially the nominee yet. That won't happen until a couple of weeks in August at the convention in Chicago. I think that, you know, we always kind of like to dream up these scenarios of a brokered convention or something. I still think right now he will still be the nominee, but does that mean that there isn't hand-wringing and a lot of very valid concerns happening right now? Absolutely. There was panic from Democrats I was talking with or texting with and emailing during the debate. And I'm not sure what he can do to allay those concerns.
So you don't think he can come back from this?
I think in the immediate future, nothing is set in stone, you know, and right now there is another debate scheduled for September. It may be good if this was, you know, his mistake, his misstep, get it out in June rather than in September, maybe when more voters are paying attention. I think he can come back from it. But this stage that he had last night in that format, he won't have again for several months. And I think, you know, in the ways that politics twists and turns, we can't rule anything out. But he absolutely squandered a very important opportunity.
Did this help Trump, or is Trump just still where he is?
I don't think that Trump won the debate, but Biden lost it. And listen, if you were skeptical of Trump and you thought that he was a liar and was going to undermine democracy, your views were probably reinforced. So I'm not sure that Trump necessarily did anything to change the minds of those undecided voters. Like I said, I still view the apathy and disengagement as Biden's biggest problem. But, you know, did he probably shore up his base who really believes that Biden is incompetent and too old? Yes. I mean, there's only, you know, 3 years between these men, 3-4 years between them. And Trump looked much younger and much more in command on that stage. You know, the White House saying Biden has caught a cold and everything, but he just appeared much, much older and much less in command than Trump did, even if most of what Trump said was misleading or false.
Jessica Taylor, political analyst and editor with the Cook Political Report. Thank you so much. Americans across the country gathered to watch the first debate of the 2024 presidential campaign season. Both President Biden and former President Trump are speaking to an electorate that has expressed strong dissatisfaction with both candidates. VOA's Dora McQuarr has reaction from voters.
From New York to Los Angeles, in Michigan and Las Vegas, even passengers on a flight from Minneapolis to Miami. Millions of Americans tuned in to watch the first 2024 debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. At pro-Trump watch parties, voters suggested Biden's performance shows he's not fit to be reelected to the nation's highest office.
I don't want to be disrespectful towards the elderly, but like Biden is, you know, he slurs his words a lot. I just don't think he's fit to be a leader.
I think it's really hard for any reasonable human being to watch that and know that Mr. Biden is fit to be our president.
I think Donald Trump, I think he did well tonight. He kept his calm and his cool.
He was holding back quite a bit, and I wish he would have tore into him more. But, you know, he's got to be polite.
Other debate watchers were disappointed the candidates didn't directly answer some questions, like Trump's pledge to deport millions of undocumented immigrants if elected.
Ex-President Trump failed to answer the question, is he going to try to deport 13 or 14 million immigrants, taking, you know, children and spouses from others, people that have been here 20, 30 years?
Or the rising cost of living.
Biden inflation. Everything is skyrocketed. Stuff is 3-4 times the price it was during Trump's era. Gas prices are way overpriced.
I think that some of the questions aren't being answered, though, by the candidates, which is unfortunate.
At a watch party for Democrats in Los Angeles, Biden supporters focused on the issues rather than assessing the performance of either candidate.
Trump is a complete liar. Everything he says is just one lie after another. And he's never going to protect us as women. He's not going to protect minorities across the nation. And he's going to make things worse for us. He's going to put us into more wars.
This is hard to watch. To see someone lying to the American public time and time again is hard to watch. Biden is really looking out for women's rights.
There is no crime wave from immigrants coming into this country. It doesn't exist. President Trump, former President Trump, is only using those words to gin up a base that only wants to create a xenophobic, racist country.
There are less than 5 months until Election Day. Voters will have another opportunity to assess the candidates at the next debate, which is scheduled for September 10th. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
For the past few election cycles, officials have been warning of foreign actors refining their efforts to covertly influence American voters about candidates. For a look at what could be creating a deepening distrust in the Democratic election process, we're joined by Sarah Bush, author and associate professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. How do you see this happening in this election season?
Well, U.S. intelligence officials have been warning that foreign actors are already preparing to and, you know, have begun campaigns to try to influence the 2024 election. And they've been focusing a lot on the plans of Russia, who's known to spread disinformation, not only with the goal of influencing election outcomes, but also with the goal of causing Americans to lose trust in democracy. I think it's not yet clear whether these efforts have expanded in 2024 relative to what we've seen in 2016 and 2020. And of course, a lot of election meddling happens covertly, and so it can be difficult to track. But I think that intelligence analysts are suggesting that, you know, the U.S. needs to be prepared for interference in the upcoming election. We should be more prepared than in the past, but whether the efforts to influence are broader than in the past, I think remains to be seen.
What's the goal? Is it to sow mistrust in specific candidates or in our election process in general?
I think it's both. Russia is known to support President Trump as a candidate in the presidential election, but it also does have a track record in the United States and in other countries around the world of trying to more generally undermine people's confidence in democracy and elections.
Can you talk a little bit about why it matters if Americans don't have trust in our election process?
Well, it's really quite dangerous for countries when the public doubts the outcomes of democratic elections. Certainly, we saw that with the January 6th insurrection. And there is kind of countless examples from other countries in which people who doubt election credibility engage in violence around elections. Kenya is a country that immediately comes to mind. But I think there's other things that we need to be worried about, too, beyond that kind of worst case scenario. When people think that their country's elections aren't credible, they're less likely to vote and they're less likely to engage in the political process in ways that will support democracy over the longer term. So I think that we also need to be worried about people disengaging from elections and from politics and losing confidence in democracy.
And speaking of democracy, there does seem to be a global trend toward voter support for autocracy over democracy. What do you attribute this to? And do you see that happening here in the U.S.? And would you say that's also partly attributed to foreign influence campaigns?
It is a global trend that's gaining ground here in the United States. And I think that Americans' waning trust in elections is something that's actually been happening for a while over the course of the 21st century. It goes back to the Bush versus Gore election in 2000. And it's continued in the subsequent years with quite a number of Republican politicians in particular, obviously exemplified by President Trump, calling American election integrity into question. That being said, I think that it is possible that foreign influence campaigns have played a role in sowing distrust in the past decade or so. In research that I've done with Lauren Prather, who is a professor at the University of California, San Diego, we have conducted surveys of Americans for a number of years now that shows that when people think that foreign meddling is happening in our elections, they tend to be less confident in American elections. And when we've provided them with information in our surveys that meddling hasn't occurred, that makes them more confident. So I think that the foreign influence piece is part of the story. But that being said, actually, we've also found that some Americans welcome foreign interference in our elections if they think it will help their preferred candidate win.
Do you see the global trend of voter support for autocracy over democracy here now as well?
I think that most Americans still support democracy. I think that the pendulum hasn't swung that far in the direction. But at the same time, we see these worrying trends of losing faith in our democratic institutions, particularly elections. And I think that, you know, that is something that's quite consequential for, you know, our politics and the future of our democracy.
Former President Donald Trump has expressed his admiration for dictators, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, openly seeming to want to emulate these strongmen. Is this new for an American president, this sort of position?
I think it's not new for the United States to be allied with non-democratic countries. Saudi Arabia comes to mind for the sake of prerogatives that American leaders may think they have, whether economic or military. But President Trump frequently didn't even pay lip service to the ideals of democracy and human rights abroad, not to mention taking steps to undermine free and fair elections here in the United States. And I think that is very unprecedented. And the 4 years of President Trump's leadership here were ones during which global autocrats, I think, felt freer to repress because they knew they were less likely to than they have been in the past to face negative consequences internationally and in terms of their relations with the U.S., whether that's economically or diplomatically or something else, if they abused human rights and democracy. So we see kind of a break with the past tradition within American foreign policy, however flawed, that has been grounded in values of democracy and human rights since the end of the Cold War.
So what can be done to rebuild Americans' trust in our elections?
I think a tricky thing is that American elections are very decentralized. So the way that elections are administered varies quite a bit from state to state. But one thing that I think can help, among other strategies, is to support nonpartisan, high-quality election observers, which happen to be a routine feature of elections in most countries around the world and are something that the U.S. government has supported overseas in its foreign policy. But I think as many as 15 American states don't allow nonpartisan election observers to monitor our polling stations. And changing that would be a valuable reform that states could take that might enhance the American public's trust in election when nonpartisan, high-quality election observers disseminate good news about our election integrity to the public. The surveys that I've done with Lauren Prather over the past decade indicate that Americans are more trusting in their elections. So I think that that is a strategy that has been shown could enhance people's trust and repair the damage that has been done.
Sarah Bush, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday announced several major decisions and plans to use its final day on Monday to announce its ruling in former President Donald Trump's claim of immunity from prosecution for trying to undo his 2020 election loss. Joining us now to discuss is Joel Paul, constitutional law professor at University of California Law, San Francisco. The Supreme Court had a ruling that was in favor of one of the people, a Pennsylvania man who was challenging charges against him of obstruction concerning the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol that he apparently participated in. What is that all about? And what does this mean going forward for a federal criminal case against Donald Trump?
The special prosecutor used this same statute, this obstruction statute, in a number of the cases brought against the various rioters in connection with the January 6th insurrection. He has charged Donald Trump, among other people, with violating the statute. In this case, said that it wasn't sufficient to simply say that the rioters were attempting to obstruct the congressional proceeding. They had to actually show that the rioters were attempting to obstruct or destroy documents, such as, for example, the electoral ballot. So in the case against Donald Donald Trump, the prosecutor now would have to either prove that Donald Trump actually sought to destroy or change the electoral ballots, or he would have to drop this charge and simply rely on the other charges against Donald Trump in connection with the January 6th riot. There are about 52 people who were charged and convicted solely under this particular statute, and those cases now might be struck down or they may have to be retried, but the vast majority of people who have been charged in connection with the January 6th riot, which is almost 1,500 people, those people were charged under multiple violations of statutes, not necessarily relying on this statute. And so those convictions will remain.
One of the major undecided cases that the justices have put off until the very last day, which will be Monday, they announced Friday, is presidential immunity. Donald Trump is arguing that former presidents are immune from prosecution for official acts. They take an office and the indictment he faces on charges of election interference should be dismissed. The special counsel requested this to be a very quick decision. This is months and months ago now, and they've waited till the last day of the term. Does that tell you something? Does that offer you any indication of how this is going to come out?
The Supreme Court's decision to hold off until Monday to decide this case means that, as a practical matter, Donald Trump cannot be tried until after the election. It simply leaves it impossible for the trial court judge to move forward until the Supreme Court has issued a ruling, and then the trial court judge will now have to apply the new principles, whatever the principles are that the court interprets. It will take a long time, and so as a practical matter, Donald Trump is not going to be able to be tried until after the election.
At first, it seemed like this was a cut and dry, and the lower courts were like, you know, presidents are not immune to being prosecuted when they're out of office. What do you expect to come out of this, and how might this impact the special counsel's allegations against Trump?
The most likely outcome is that the Supreme Court is going to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and send it back to the lower court with instructions for the lower court to decide which of the actions of President Trump are considered to be private actions and which are considered official actions. And the court, I suspect, based on the questions they asked during the oral proceedings, are likely to say that if President Trump was acting in an official capacity, then he retains his immunity. But if he was acting in a private capacity, he has no immunity. Now, to the average person, it seems pretty clear that trying to prevent your political rival from being elected president by preventing the counting of the electoral votes is not acting in his official capacity as president. But we'll have to wait for the lower court to make that decision. And then the lower court's decision can be appealed right back up to the Supreme Court again.
So you think we're really not going to have any clarity at this point other than this will delay any of the cases against Donald Trump?
It seems pretty clear now that that is the court's intention. The fact that two members of the court, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, have refused to recuse themselves in spite of the fact that their spouses both have made known their own position. In the case of Justice Thomas, his wife actually has been a witness in the investigations of the rioters, suggests that the court really does not want to see this case go to trial anytime soon. And I'm afraid that it's just going to be left up to the voters to decide whether or not the actions that the president allegedly committed during the riots, whether or not that makes him unfit for office. Basically, for the court to decide that the president has any immunity from criminal prosecution is really remarkable given the principle that no man is above the law. I mean, that seems like such a fundamental principle of our legal system. And it's a principle which is embedded in the Supreme Court's most famous decision, Marbury versus Madison. In the Nixon tapes cases, the Supreme Court decided that a sitting president who has private communications in his office with his own aides, with the members of the Department of Justice, with the Attorney General, with the White House counsel, and who is not a criminal suspect, can still be forced to turn over those tapes to the prosecutor in a criminal criminal investigation of someone else. So Afroshiori, it seems like a man who is not president, who is no longer president, who's been voted out of office, who engages in a conspiracy to cause an insurrection to prevent the counting of votes, surely has no kind of immunity. But, you know, that's what is at stake in this case.
Joel Paul, constitutional law professor at University of California Law, San Francisco. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. And that is all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.